You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, June 18th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, more from my time at Netroots Nation, an interview with Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio, an interview with Abe Bonowitz, the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. Yes, two for the price of zero for many of you today. Of course, many of you also are supporters of the program and allow it to continue. Meanwhile, elections across the globe, in Greece, the New Democracy Party has now formed a coalition government with PASOK. Sure I'm not pronouncing that correctly. Forming a coalition government in Greece, Syriza not gaining enough seats in parliament and will not join that government, instead be in the opposition. What does it mean? Well, the negotiations will continue. Some are calling it a pro-austerity vote or a pro-bailout vote. I think we're sort of back to where we were a couple of weeks ago. But we shall see. I have read so many different people on this, I cannot make heads nor tails of what will happen. I don't think anybody knows. Will Greece leave the euro? Who knows? Will they simply default? Who knows? We don't know. Elections in Egypt. Muslim Brotherhood takes the presidency. The military says the presidency is not important anymore. And in France, the Socialist Party won enough seats in parliament to form a government. We'll see what happens there. We know what's going to happen in this country. Well, not really. The march towards austerity seems to be taking place all across the globe. And stay tuned for more. The Affordable Care Act ruling not taking place today from the Supreme Court. Could be Thursday. Most people are thinking next week or the week after. Interesting stories, which we'll get to in the better half of the show today, about where we can look across the country for examples of healthcare reform that originally included a mandate and then the mandate reversed. Also, a great piece in the New Republic about just who would benefit from the Affordable Care Act, who stands to lose if the entire piece of legislation is overturned. And also in the better half of the program, an update from Voyager 1, which went up into the space years before Matt was even a twinkle in his parents' eye. Even before he was a twinkle of a twinkle. Seems to be pushing the boundaries of our solar system. We'll talk about that, but first, Abe Bonawith from the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty right now. Joining me now, live from Netroots Nation 2012 in Providence, Rhode Island, is Abe Bonawith. He is the Director of Affiliate Support for the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. Abe, thanks for joining me.
Greetings. Glad to be here.
So, Abe, now, I know over the past, and I want to talk about the issue. Well, let's talk about, let's start with the state of the death penalty in this country. It seems to me that we're starting to see some progress that we hadn't seen really over the past, I don't know, decade.
Well, yeah, our organization has been around for 35 years. We were started in the wake of the Gregg decision in 1976, which upheld new death penalty laws that were written after the Furman decision in 72, struck down all the death penalty laws. So, you know, it's been quite a struggle. And through the 90s, we had almost 100 executions some years. But now we're actually starting to win. We have in the past five years seen five states abandon the death penalty: New York, New Jersey, New Mexico, Illinois, and just a few weeks ago, Connecticut. And sitting right across the aisle from us is the Speaker of the Connecticut House, who helped make that happen during an interview with somebody else. So it's, you know, it is a, it's an issue that more and more people are understanding. You know, politicians are understanding it's not the third rail. But more important, people are getting, regardless of where you stand on whether or not we should kill murderers, that the system isn't working, that the system can't be trusted, that it's a terrible waste of money, that we can do better for victim family members, we can do better for law enforcement and give them better tools to actually prevent crime and solve unsolved crimes rather than waste the money on something that we're not really using anyway.
Have the gains in terms of, for those of us who oppose the death penalty, Have the gains been a function of technology? I mean, I guess it was a couple of weeks ago, I saw a report that showed thousands of people have been wrongly incarcerated and have later released. Now, those weren't,
that's right,
those weren't
new
death penalty. Those weren't death penalty cases, but if you can make a mistake in any case, you can make a mistake in a death penalty case.
Well, exactly. And that is a new database that was just launched that that is looking at all exonerations. We focus, of course, on people exonerated who were sentenced to death. I'll note that of the 140 on the official list, I think only 14 or 15 were DNA exonerations. So in other words, it took DNA to get them off. But in most of the cases, it's some other, you know, mistaken witness identification, police misconduct, a combination of a number of things. But luckily, there was some mechanism for that challenge to be looked at. So, but technology is a part of it. Really, what's happening is people are just realizing it's not working. It's a failed public policy.
I mean, that's fascinating to me because I would have imagined that it was a function of DNA, that it was technology, and that was changing it. So what is happening? Are there more instances where people are going back and trying to exonerate people? Is it, I mean...
Well, the innocence issue is one that's a very powerful issue for our movement, for people especially that aren't yet with us opposed to the death penalty. And we actually have a campaign about that. Shoutingfromtherooftops.org is the webpage, which actually that comes from Justice Scalia in 2006 in an opinion actually wrote that if it was proven that we had executed a person who was innocent, they'd be shouting his name from the rooftops. So we're starting to do that. Cameron Todd Willingham, Carlos de Luna, we can't say he's absolutely innocent, but Troy Davis was, you know, the hashtag with that was too much doubt. And that's those are the things that have really exploded this movement in a way, especially the Troy Davis case. If you want to talk about technology,
right?
You know, the night he was killed, Troy Davis and the hashtag Too Much Doubt were trending topics on Twitter. Okay,
interesting. I mean, this, so what we're seeing, and when we see the rollback of the death penalty, it really is mostly about the notion of its efficacy, right? I mean, you know, as opposed to, I find it philosophically abhorrent. But it seems that there hasn't been a massive change in that, but there is a far great. There has been a change in terms of the perception that it just doesn't work.
Exactly, and really, what is starting to move it is the fact that actually conservatives and other unlikely allies are coming to the table. And this is the only issue that you see. One of the only issues you see the ACLU and the Catholic Conference sitting together at the table on. Okay, but we have a number of conservatives that have taken this on. In Kansas, the bill that's going to be running this upcoming legislative session is sponsored by Republicans, and for them, it's a fiscal issue. And for some of them, it's also their pro-life, Catholic or otherwise, and for them, it's about being consistently pro-life. But the main impetus for that bill was the budget cutting that they have to do, and the recognition that when a county prosecutor decides that he or she is going to seek a death sentence, they're going to spend a bunch more money, and it's a crapshoot because half of all death sentences are overturned during the appeals process. So you could be wasting all that money eventually, and. You know, in California, we're coming up in November. We're going to see a ballot initiative. It's called the Safe California Campaign. They have figured out that they're going to spend, if California does not abolish the death penalty, it's going to spend $1 billion in the next 5 years just to maintain its death row of more than 700 people.
How long have you been working for
the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty? I've been working for about 4 years as an employee. I was on their board previously. I've been a supporter and a member of the organization since I got involved in this in the late 1980s.
So, did you think at that time that the push and the momentum to abolish the death penalty would be driven by an issue like cost and efficacy, or did you think that?
Well, I tell you, for me, I came to this issue as a person ready to pull the switch myself. I was for the death penalty. I went to a meeting on the campus of Ohio State University of a group called Amnesty International, and there was a speaker. I had heard about Amnesty as a group that tries to free prisoners of conscience, you know, people in prison for their beliefs and their religion. I was down with that, but there was a speaker talking about the death penalty in the United States. And I said, well, this is the United States. We have the best justice system in the world. If we have the death penalty, it's fine with me. I'll pull the switch myself. And I set out to try to prove those people wrong. And in doing so, I found out everything I believed about the death penalty, the truth was the opposite. And the thing that literally jumped me from one side of the fence to the other was learning that you have to kill in a county that can afford a death penalty trial. I'm from Ohio, is where I grew up, and in Ohio, you got to kill somebody in Hamilton County, Franklin County, Cuyahoga County, that's Cincinnati, Columbus, Cleveland, Toledo, Akron, Dayton, the big cities. Those counties have enough tax revenue to pay for a death penalty trial. The rural counties can't afford it, and therefore you can't get a death sentence, except in Ohio, the only condition where the state pays for the trial is if the murder occurs in a state institution, such as a prison. So
fascinating.
For me, it was this question of fairness. You cross the county line, and you can't get the ultimate punishment. I thought that was wrong. And now we know that fewer than 1%, if you look at a map of the whole country broken down by county, and where the death sentences and where the executions come from by county, we see that fewer than 1% of all the counties in this country have sent people to death row to be executed. Okay, and if you think about a system that's fair, and, you know, a lot of people, when I was the director of Floridians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty, you know, the politicians there, Jeb Bush was the governor then, they would say, well, we're doing this for the victims' families. And if we have a commodity for any subset of us, in this case victim families, the death penalty execution is a commodity for them, what we're saying to the vast majority of victim family members is your loved one wasn't valuable enough, because fewer than 1% of all the people who are eligible for the death penalty actually get a death sentence and stay on death row to the point of execution. So we have a system that's not equal or fair.
Interesting.
And carved into the face of the U.S. Supreme Court building are the words equal justice under law. And we don't have that.
And have you come to see it? Are you still at the point where if it was fair, if the federal government said, we're going to fund any death penalty case that any county anywhere wants to bring, have your thoughts on the issue evolved?
I'm glad you asked, because that's the next part of my story. Is in 1993, I went on an event called The Journey of Hope from Violence to Healing, which was sponsored by a group called Murder Victim Families for Reconciliation, which is one of the groups in our movement that is made up of murder victim family members who reject the death penalty. And that was a speaking tour. It was through the state of Indiana, and it was led by victim family members but joined by the families of people on death row and the families of the people who have been executed, and also people who were wrongly convicted and sent to death row. And meeting them and coming to understand their stories and these family members' stories, who are not the killer and the victim, but the people around them, the collateral damage of the death penalty, and understanding that is what moved my heart. So the facts and this fairness issue changed my head. Meeting the people and understanding the collateral damage of the death penalty moved my heart. And now, especially, I didn't even get this for a long time, but we've come to understand something called secondary trauma, which is what happens to people that clean up murder scenes, people like prosecutors and judges and defense attorneys and
everyone
police
involved
officers.
In actually executing the execution.
Well, the executioners, too. So whenever something's happening, like my friend Bill Pelkey, who led that Journey of Hope from Violence to Healing in Indiana, his grandmother was murdered, and he supported the 15-year-old girl who did that getting the death sentence. She was the youngest female on death row in the country at the time, back when we executed juvenile offenders. And he would talk about how every time the case would come up, the picture they would put up, not a picture, a beautiful picture of his grandmother and what she looked like in life, but they would show the picture of her body being wheeled out of the house that she was killed in. And he talks about how that re-traumatized him. But onto the wardens, we now have among us, you know, the executive director of our California affiliate, Death Penalty Focus in California, this woman named Jeannie Woodford. She used to be the warden of San Quentin. She executed four people. And she's now the executive director of an organization working to abolish the death penalty in California. We've got six or seven, or actually eight now, former executioners, former corrections officials who oversaw executions, who are saying this does not work for prison workers. You know, Ron McAndrew, who conducted the last electric chair executions in Florida and the first lethal injections as warden of Union Correctional Institute, Florida State, the one that they do the executions in. Sorry, I'm blanking on that. He talks about the prisoners that he killed visiting him in his dreams. You know, they got together. The first action that this group of wardens did was prior to the execution of Troy Davis. They together wrote a letter that they sent to the Georgia corrections officials, basically saying, look, you should go back and ask the Board of Pardons to reconsider, but if they don't, then at least say to the workers in the prison, you do not have to participate in this execution. Because our experience is that the most haunting of executions are the ones where the prisoner has said, I'm not guilty. Okay.
And
even in Louisiana, one last thing on this. In Louisiana, just recently, they passed unanimously a bill that allows prison workers to not participate in executions.
I wasn't aware that you didn't have an option.
Well, in most places you don't, but I can tell you
that's that pretty stunning.
Prison workers, you know, this people say, well, take away the TV, take away all the prisoners' rights. People don't get that making sure there are good and comfortable conditions in prison is what keeps prison workers safe.
Right.
And if you want to have a prison condition where we're treating a person worse than we would treat an animal, then, you know, you cannot be surprised when that person strikes back. And if you want to have people in a position where they can't strike back, you're talking about super segregation, and that is the most expensive type of incarceration. So, you know, you have to give and take somewhere.
Abe, we just have a minute left. Where can people go online to get involved.
Well, most importantly, shoutingfromtherooftops.org is where you can take the pledge to end executions, to be involved in the movement. It'll sign you up. We'll be able to connect you to the state organization in the state that you live in. And that's what we really advocate, is for people to be involved at the state level, moving legislation state by state, because that's how we're going to end up getting rid of the death penalty, is state by state.
And if someone has a friend or a relative who's a supporter of the death penalty and they want to convince them, they want to show them facts as to why the death penalty doesn't work, or
find out what their motivation is for supporting the death penalty, and then go and get the information that refutes it. And they can find it on our webpage, or the Death Penalty Information Center is really a great resource for all of us, deathpenaltyinfo.org. But that's really here's the best part, the best news is this. We don't need to change anybody's minds. All we need is for the people who are with us to actually do something, to join our organization, to be active in their state, to contact your own legislators and say, I want you to abolish the death penalty in the state. If everybody who was with us did that, we'd be done.
Well, Abe Bonowitz, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's a great pleasure.
Okay, that was Abe Bonowitz in an interview that I did with him at Netroots Nation about a week and change ago. And another interview I did at Netroots Nation about a week and change ago. What'd you guys think I was doing there? Just hanging out? Going to bars in Providence? No, I was working. Working full time. This next interview is with Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio. It's a little hot in places. It breaks up a little bit. I apologize. 1,000 apologies for that. If we get 60 new members in the next 5 hours, I will take an audio recording class. In the event that we don't, I'll keep trying to make it better. All right, here's that interview with Senator Sherrod Brown. Continuing our coverage from Netroots Nation 2012, sitting with me is Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio. Senator, real pleasure to talk to you.
Good to be here. Thanks. In person?
In person.
Sitting
at Netroots Nation.
With its cool Ring of Fire wraparound thing on the microphone.
Indeed, yes.
How cool is that?
Yes, it's very cool. I'm glad you mentioned that so we can...
Do I mention the sign overlooking us, the Ring of Fire radio sign?
That actually helps with the home office.
Okay.
So the more that you can confirm that it's there.
It's there. It's scary looking. It's interesting looking. And it's, I'll stop there.
Authoritative?
Authoritative. That's it.
All right. Well.
Intimidating.
All right. Let's talk about, I want to get to student loans, because I know this is an issue that you've been working on. But there are some really pressing issues for our audience that I want to talk to you about as well. We keep hearing quite a bit now about the fiscal cliff that we're going to hit in the lame duck session or at the beginning of 2013. And there seems to be at least, let me ask you, do you think that there is a coherent Democratic strategy to deal with all these things? We've got the Bush tax cuts expiring. We've got the debt limit reached and voted upon. We've got the automatic cuts that are supposed to take place. We've got the end of unemployment benefits and the moratorium on Social Security taxes. Is there a Democratic sort of game plan on how to deal with this?
I think there is. The answer is no, not now. But the better answer is, I think we're building towards that. I think the president's thinking a lot about that. We're talking to the White House about it. We're talking to each other about it. There is general consensus on a number of things among Democrats. There is some disagreement. I mean, there's disagreement. A small number of Democrats are probably want to do some things with Medicare and Social Security that the great majority of Democrats and the president don't. I think that the corporate tax rules, there is general agreement. There's general agreement with Democrats on most of that. Eliminating the Bush tax cuts on high income people. There's general agreement, and it should be at $250,000, which the president's asking for. A few Democrats think it should be at a higher level than that. Most of us don't. So I think there's the makings of that, but I think I mean, obviously the election is going to have a huge impact on that.
Right.
How many seats we I don't think we're going to lose the majority in the Senate. I think we may win the majority in the House. I think the president's going to get reelected. So, and I think at some point the business community steps up and says to Republicans, you're not going to play those games with the debt limit again. You're going to pass some things like a transportation bill. You're going to do some things that the country needs that the Tea Party has blocked, and you're going to have to start acting like adults. And I think that push coming from the business community and the electorate is going to make it much clearer from November on.
I hope you're right about that in terms of impacting the Republicans. But I want to touch on two things that you mentioned. One is, when you say there are some Democrats who have some ideas about Social Security and Medicare, Social Security in particular, let's take, but the most Democrats and the president disagree with those. What are you talking about? Because as far as I know, I mean, in terms of the reporting, the president had put on the table with a deal with Boehner to cut Social Security by raising the retirement age and to cut it by decreasing the cost of living increases.
Yeah.
Where do you stand on that? And give me your sense of where the president stands.
Well, I think the president, I know where I am, and where I am is you don't raise the retirement age. Because the number of people I meet every day almost that are working in a diner or that are working in construction or working retail or cutting hair or cleaning hotel rooms or working in manufacturing, they can't work till they're 70 years old.
Right.
And just because I wear a tie to work and you know, walk around the Capitol and go to and set up round tables in Ohio and I can work to a later age than that probably, but many people can't. We have no business raising the retirement age. And the cost of living adjustment right now doesn't reflect the real cost of living increase for seniors because it's pegged more to a 40-year-old working than it is a 70-year-old retiree because of its reflection of health care costs. So I assume the president will stand strong on that, and I hope he does. And I think most of my great majority of my colleagues will. A few of them think we should raise the retirement age, I think. But I'm a Democratic colleagues, but most of them are going to be strong on that. You got to make sure they are.
And I appreciate that, and I think you're right about it. And, of course, you obviously know, that life expectancy hasn't really grown that much as people tend to think. So for people in the bottom half of the income distribution, it's about 2 years it's gained in the past 70. So, and moving on, you mentioned there are some Democrats who have some there's some disparity between what constitutes where the Bush tax cuts should expire, and the president has maintained that it should be for the first dollar made over $250,000. But we're hearing, we say some Democrats. The leader of the Democrats in the House, Nancy Pelosi, has come out with $1 million as limit. What's going on there? I mean,
I don't know how to answer that. I do know that I do believe that in the end, as it gets closer to making a decision, keeping it at 250, if the president insists on it, the Congress will go with that. And I really do believe the Democrats in the Congress will go with that. And we need to. We need to draw the. I mean, you win elections. And you govern by drawing bright lines. You need to compromise sometimes, certainly, I understand that. But you particularly win elections by showing whose side are you on. And I think President Obama understands that. He ran a very effective race in 2008. He will do the same this year. And he understands you do that by making those bright lines. I think members of the House and Senate will, by and large, come into line there and understand those same bright lines.
Let's talk about, some of the... One of the implications, I know that you've been subject to a tremendous amount of corporate money being thrown at your race in Ohio, and that is part of, or perhaps the cause in many respects, for a tremendous amount of income disparity that we're now seeing, record levels, and also sort of the implications for things across the board. I know that one of the things you're working on is student loans. Let's talk about that a little bit because we're now seeing over $1 trillion worth of debt that students have in this country, or ex-students, I should say. And it is, some people think that it may be the next big bubble in the financial industry that pops, but at the very least, it is a huge drag
on the growth of the economy and for the living conditions for Americans. What can we do to alleviate that? It seems to me that the answers that we're seeing all deal with providing more loans or maintaining low interest rates. Shouldn't we be going back to a system where we actually provide an option for essentially a free higher education?
Of course we should. I mean, the best days of California were when it had the best university system at, you know, relatively low cost. For it get Cal State and UCal system, Cal State and community colleges, and you look at the prosperity in that country, and that's the way it is everywhere. I mean, in Ohio, we are seeing state universities, the continued cuts from the legislature in state universities. It means tuition goes up, means people have to borrow more money, and even if we lock in this 3.4%, which we absolutely need to, it still means the costs are, the debt is huge. The average Ohio student who graduates from a four-year school that borrowed money owes $27,000. This would add $1,000 a year if we don't lock in this lower interest rate. And my wife graduated from Kent State, first in her family to go to college 30 plus years ago, graduated with less than $2,000 in debt. And that's the way it used to be. And we what do we do with the next generation if we continue to burden them with more and more student loan debt? And a big part of that is states not providing what they should for colleges and universities. It's more complicated than that, to be sure, but that's fundamentally the biggest part of it. And coupled with universities not keeping their costs in check better than they have. And the president's worked on them on that, but there are lots we need to do.
I mean, isn't on some level there is a point, I think, to the idea that, you know, providing loans as a means in which making a college affordable for students is in fact helping sort of at least increase some of the pressure on the rise in tuition costs. I mean, we're subsidizing that those rises in tuition costs,
yeah,
with loans, and where we could be doing this much more efficiently from the other side. But to a certain extent, I'm restating what you just said.
That's an interesting point. I think that's probably right. Yeah.
Let me ask you this. We're also there's been stories recently. I mean, of course, we're probably weeks away from hearing from the Supreme Court in terms of their ruling on the Affordable Care Act. What do you think happens? I'll give you two scenarios. They strike the mandate, or they strike the whole law. What do you think happens, particularly with the Republicans? Because there's now talk that some of your Republican colleagues in the Senate are beginning to get a little worried that people will lose the opportunity to have their kids get health insurance up until the age of 26. Seems to be some concern amongst your Senate colleagues that people are starting to become aware of the fact that they may lose the opportunity to get health insurance even if they have a pre-existing condition. What do you think is going to happen?
I think it's going to be upheld, but I don't have any inside information. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not an acute student of the Supreme Court. But I think that if it's struck down either in part or in full, it creates chaos in far too many American families. A 10-year-old met a family with a 10-year-old daughter with diabetes the other day in Columbus, and her that family probably loses. It has insurance now because of the Affordable Care Act. It probably would lose it. The 22-year-old young woman who is on getting cancer treatment on her mom and dad's health plan, her cancer treatment could stop. These aren't alarmist stories. These are facts that very well could happen, as you know, if the bill struck down in part or in total. The 1.1 million Ohioans have already gotten assistance, have already gotten benefits from this Affordable Care Act already. 1.1 million seniors in Ohio. Less expensive prescription drugs save several hundred dollars each, and the no copay and deductible, getting physicals, all the things that...
Right, the free preventative care.
Yeah, all that. And so I just think these stories are going to just wash across the newspapers and televisions and radio stations and blogosphere in this country. And people are going to say, well, I was against Obamacare, but I like these things. Well, what happens then? That's in the end why I think this will be upheld, is I think even people who seem as tone deaf and as hard-hearted, if I could use that word, towards working-class families as do many on the Roberts Court, then enough of them are going to decide, yeah, this would be too destructive to far too many families in our country.
I mean, I know this is pretty much a hypothetical, but in the event that part of it is struck down, what do you think that your Republican colleagues
are going to do? I think they'll do nothing. I mean, they've said all along that the answer is sell across state lines, health savings accounts, and tort reform, and those are just minimal changes, really, in the law in terms of affecting the number of uninsured or the cost of health care. It would hurt plenty of people the tort reform would end up keeping people from getting any redress often for malpractice or other things. The others would make little difference in the number of people that have insurance and can get care. It would be a disaster for the country. I think if it's struck down, it will hurry the day that we have Medicare for all in this country.
Right.
I think that's increasingly evident to me that it gets us there faster in some sense.
That the Affordable Care Act, one way or another, gets
us there
faster.
I think it's going to happen either way. But I think it may happen faster if they strike this down, which
right.
is a peculiar, ironic sort of way to look at it. Considering what the right wing wants to do.
Right. That's it. That was an amazing strategy if someone had planned that out.
They are smarter than we think.
Now, I know that you've done a lot. I know that you sit on a committee dealing with protecting consumers in the financial, their financial dealings. Give me your sense of the Financial Fraud Task Force. Has it been as active as you had hoped at this point that Attorney General Schneiderman has been a part of? Have we seen enough activity both by the Department of Justice and the various regulatory agencies?
No, we have. I mean, the pressure in this whole regulatory system shifted from lobbying Congress to weakening and diluting and scaling back any kinds of regulatory efforts that are necessary both to implement Dodd-Frank and just simply to regulate the behavior of Wall Street. You see it, I mean, the example of what happened at J.P. Morgan Chase, that may or may not be an example of this, unclear still, but it's clear that we do need better, stronger rules. And, I mean, it goes back to the issue I worked on with Dodd-Frank, first in this form of a bill with Senator Coffin from Delaware and then later for an amendment. Got 33 votes on the Senate floor to force banks to divest some of their holdings, the largest six banks. It would simply, the largest six banks now, their combined assets are 60%+ of GDP. 25 years ago, it was half that or less.
They're bigger than before the crisis.
They're much bigger than before and are continuing to be, partly because they get implicit or indirect government subsidies because they can borrow money in the open market cheaper than First National Bank of Sycamore, Ohio, or in Coldwater, or
indeed,
the,
and then they
National
make their money
City.
By yeah. loaning it back to us.
And then they make bits right. And so, I've increasingly see, I think the time was ready for the breaking up the banks 2 years ago, but I think the Congress and the House and the Senators, more and more members are seeing. The time is increasingly more ready for breaking these banks up. I think it's something that's going to happen. It's not going to happen this
really?
Year. It's one of those things that I think the only logical outcome of these companies, banks getting bigger and bigger and bigger, is we've got to do something about it. I've had a few members who voted no on my amendment, saying I may have made a mistake on that back 2 years ago.
Interesting.
And that number is going to grow. I mean that is a prediction. And then again, I mean Yogi Berra said. Stuff to make predictions because they're about the future, but
right.
But still, on the other hand, I never quote
Are
Yankees.
You,
ever,
have so. Any of your Republican colleagues said
one
that?
One Republican
to you?
Has said something to me that he didn't quite say he'd vote for it, but he said it's starting to make a lot more sense than it made 2 years ago.
Interesting.
And a couple of Democrats have said yes, they would have voted for it.
Oh, that's
it didn't.
I guess somewhat encouraging.
Yeah,
that
it's
we
not,
won't
it's
have
not
to
enough,
wait for
yeah.
the next.
I mean, I don't stand in front, stand on the Senate floor, and they line up to come say me, "Hey, Senator Brown, you're right about that breaking up the bank stuff. We should have voted." I mean, it's not a wave yet.
I understand.
It's not like Citizens United unleashing all this money, but it's happening.
Tell me what your colleagues in general think about Citizens United.
I think the Democrats think. It's terrible for democracy and it's bad for us. I think the Republicans acknowledge to each other it's terrible for democracy and good for them. politically, and they don't say that out loud to me. I mean, my state, I don't make this about one state, but my state, they spent $7 million in it. They've actually just slightly over that now. They just did a new buy. Karl Rove pretty much directs the orchestra here. So this group comes in, then that group, then this group, all funded, we assume, by Exxon and the Koch brothers and the same cast of characters, all of whom benefit from Citizens United. I mean, when our side spends a lot of money, if George Soros would put $30 million into Citizens United on our side, and we win, he doesn't get material benefit from it. So right. much he feels good, and right. he knows it's a good thing for the country.
Right.
When the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson put $30 million each, they get, and they're successful, they get tax cuts, they get weaker environmental laws, they get labor law, rollbacks of strong labor laws. And that's really the position of this. That's why our grassroots efforts are so important. I mean, we have a website, as some others do, SherrodBrown.com. We've had 150,000 people come on that website, SherrodBrown.com, and sign our petition. It's the way we fight back. It's going
right.
to mean a different Supreme Court, a constitutional amendment, the Disclose Act, a whole bunch of different ways to fight back against this. But when you see this assault on with money at the top, and then you see this rollback of voter rights in Florida and Ohio and Wisconsin and other places, it really, and I don't say this to be alarmist or with any histrionics, but it really is a threat to our democracy. You try to keep people from voting, and at the same time you spend so much money on your unanswered message. In my state, they'd spent almost $5 million against me
yes.
before there had been a cent come in for me. And the ratio is still, I don't know, 6-1 or something.
Yeah, it's pretty stunning, the enormous amount of money. Yeah. And this is extending a trend that has already existed.
Yeah.
This
right,
is not
right.
reversing yeah. anything. It's only yeah. amplifying a trend that's going in the wrong direction.
But it's extending it by a ratio, a factor of 2 or 3 or 4. Yeah, it's... Anyway, go ahead.
I want to jump back just to the if I could, and I know you've got to go, but I want to just jump back to the extension of the Bush tax cuts.
Sure.
What do you think the best way for the Democrats, if you were capable of having your colleagues do as you tell them? What do you think is the best strategy here in terms of dealing with that?
Well, it may be something Al Franken suggested, that. You know, that we pass a bill saying right now extending the middle class tax cuts for another, and go on record for another year or two, so that when the other ones expire, they just expire. Right now, the Republicans will believe, whether it's, I'm not sure it's right, that they have the upper hand, because if we insist on only upper income and they say it's got to be everybody, that we insist on extending it only for the middle class, and they
right.
say extend it for everybody. What would happen if there is gridlock or deadlock is
they
middle
all
class
expire.
People's taxes go up. So, I
but
think
isn't
Frank
it the opposite? Because
few.
Don't you have the ability then on January 25th of 2013 to come in and introduce a middle class tax cut at that point?
Yeah.
So, you know, we're talking that is retroactive to
yeah, we
the
do.
20,
we do.
The first. And so the yeah. leverage is really, it seems to me that it's the opposite, that the leverage is actually on the Democratic side, because you could do as Senator Franken suggests and offer that bill now, but you could also offer
you
it
can offer, that's right,
in,
that's
in
right.
January.
I think
it works both ways.
I think you're probably right. I mean, I think the Republicans think you're wrong on that. I think you're probably right.
They think I'm wrong on a lot of this.
Well, they probably, I think they do, starting with that scary picture.
Indeed.
There, yes. But I think that you may be right, and I think we've got to really hang tough, and we've got to say what we mean and mean what we say here, and we've got to stick to it. And we haven't always done that. And that's really important. The president does. And I hope he's emboldened coming out of this election in a way that he will.
Senator Sherrod Brown,
good to
Ohio.
Be back. Thank you.
You're one of my favorite senators in the Senate.
And you're one of the best radio shows out there, man.
You know, Franken, of course, I have to say that he's my favorite. But
I take that personally, man.
I understand.
Al Franken once told me, when I said something funny to him, I thought was funny, he said, "Sherrod, just because I'm a comedian doesn't make you funny." And it's not like he'd never used that line before, but
no,
I'm resentful still about
no,
it.
No, I understand. Yeah, that's
thanks.
The, that's the
you.
Problem
thanks,
with
buddy.
Us. Thanks, comedians. Good talking
thanks.
To you.
All right.
All right, folks, that is our, or at least part of our program for today.
Once again, let me remind you, you can support this show by becoming a member at majority.fm. You can also support this show by doing other things that you can find at majority.fm/support the show. You can buy coffee, tea, chocolate at justcoffee.coop. I'm holding here in my hand a bag of branded justcoffee.coop, majority.fm coffee. It's delicious. 10% discount code using the word majority. Also, if you buy your Amazon crap and you buy it through our link at majority.fm/support the show, we get a little kickback. We will head into the better half of the program where I will be discussing Voyager 1, a protest against the stop and frisk in Manhattan this weekend. These stories on the Affordable Care Act, we are just weeks away, days away, from hearing how the Supreme Court is going to rule. And apparently Justice Scalia, I mean, you shouldn't be surprised by this, but he's come out with a book saying that he now disavows some of his prior rulings and opinions wherein he supported an expansive reading of the Commerce Clause, just in time for him to no longer believe an expansive reading of the Commerce Clause. Further, proving to the world that, A, he's just a partisan hack, and B, as he gets older, he has no problem with more and more people realizing that. We will talk about that also in the program. And congratulations to our listeners who are CEOs of multinational corporations. Your pay continues to go up. Surprising we don't see more jobs out of that, but I guess that's just the way it is. All right, folks, 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM. Tomorrow on the program, we will have more from Netroots Nation. Tomorrow, Bill McKibben and Dave Zirin. Both great interviews. Bill McKibben tomorrow alludes to a new pact, something secret that he's got in the works for the day after the election. And Dave Zirin, just a great perspective on different aspects of sports, how political they are, and how I'm sure you hadn't thought about it. That's tomorrow. And again, join me in the better half. Just support the show. You don't have to listen to the extra content if you don't want. But if you want the show to continue, May was one of the cruelest months for us in terms of members. A lot of people hurting out there. So if you... if you can afford to become a member and support the existence of this program, now's a great time. See you tomorrow or in just a moment.